Making our way here back with cases from the community, integrating new research findings into clinical practice. Again, a multi-tumor symposium with American Oncology Network and Research to Practice. So moving on to what's historically been a difficult disease space, but some super exciting breakthroughs in the last few years. Hepatobiliary cancers will be module 5. We're blessed to have Dr. Lee join us and provide expertise. He's associate professor at the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics at City of Hope. And these are his disclosures. This is the data that we have within the network. I thought this was a crazy high number for hepatocellular carcinoma. I think perhaps Dr. Patel and Dr. Mulheron's clinics are too close to the bars or, relative to biliary tract cancers, quite a bit of hepatocellular carcinoma. There'll be questions later about differentiating some of those blended tumors. But we also look at utilization of treatments within the network, atezo-bev versus durva-tremi. And patients with FGFR abnormalities, we had an interesting ocular toxicity from the previous, and some of that will dovetail here. Again, it takes a village to take care of these patients. Not a lot of overlap in the TDXD space in this setting. We'll start with a case and then pose a few questions. You can feel free to answer those, or you can sort of defer to address them as the data rolls out. So, Dr. Warsh.
The next case is presented by Dr. Warsh, a patient with metastatic cholangiocarcinoma and an FGFR2 fusion.
This is a 66-year-old guy, overall extremely healthy. There's been newer data where we add in immunotherapy in with the chemo doublet and with the durvalumab and pembrolizumab approved. As the question is, do you guys have a preference? Was some data more overwhelming or more positive in one or the other? Or is it more just where the chemo plus immunotherapy we know is good? We do have a little positive news with this FGFR2 fusion mutation that is a very good target. So I'm curious how often you guys have seen this mutation. What the experience is with response rates? Do people tolerate this well? And have people been able to stay on this for a long time? Or is it something where maybe you get a good few months, then have to transition to another therapy? And I think this is approved for second line, so I would do the chemo immunotherapy up front, but it's always good to have that in our back pocket if we need to afterwards.
Yeah, so I think maybe, regarding that first question, I'll just kind of walk you through the data in terms of, how I see it. So thanks for the kind introduction and thanks to the organizing committee for having me.
Perfect. Just to set the stage, a couple of questions for you to think through. For patients with newly diagnosed advanced biliary tract cancer, we mentioned the durva or pembro. Do you have a preference up front with chemotherapy on the platinum Gemzar plus?
Yeah, sure. So I think that's a really good question. As I will show you, really not much of a difference between these two trials. I would say that the main difference is that the TOPAZ-1 trial essentially stopped chemotherapy after 6 months of treatment, and you just continue with single agent IO with durvalumab maintenance, whereas the KEYNOTE trial with pembrolizumab did allow you to continue chemo abate with single agent gemcitabine with the pembrolizumab IO. So I think those are just kind of the real differences, and I think it's just up to your patient whether or not they want a full chemo break or go on just IO, or if they maybe have a little bit more aggressive disease and you think that the chemo is helping, then continuing the chemo with the IO.
And with respect to the FGFR inhibitors, I know we're going to go through some data with pemigatinib, futibatinib. Particularly your experience, has this been a positive thing? I mean, I know we were in need of any and all breakthroughs possible here, so we were very thankful and grateful. But they have some very unique toxicities, right? And so we'll go through those decks, but if you could highlight just briefly what those would be.
Absolutely. I think the FGFR inhibitor story is actually very promising and has really helped our patients with biliary tract cancers, particularly cholangiocarcinomas. I can tell you from my personal experience, some of these duration of responses that we're seeing with this agent is really paramount. So I had a patient who was able to, make it to her 80th birthday. And I think, for you out here, from the Asian culture, that 80th birthday is a pivotal milestone in someone's life. And I could just see the joy on her face, being able to enjoy her birthday with her friends. And she's, you know, she had toxicity that we'll go over, but we were able to manage that toxicity and get her there, which was a prominent milestone that she wanted to achieve.
That's a great story. So speaking, when we get into the FGFR inhibitors, thoughts about sequencing those if progression on a prior, is there any value there?
Yeah, so I think we don't really necessarily know. For some of the research that has been done in this area, particularly by Lipico-Goyal, you know, we know that there are certainly gatekeeper mutations that develop after potential initial treatment with an FGFR inhibitor. And we know that next generation FGFR inhibitors are trying to target some of these, kind of gatekeeper mutations. With the FGFR, you know, inhibitors that we have, you know, so far right now, it appears that, you know, futibatinib, for example, has a little bit broader in terms of target and can potentially overcome some of the resistance to prior FGFR treatment. So, you know, one proposed sequence of treatment would be to potentially start with pemigatinib, and then if they develop resistance, go to futibatinib. But, you know, outside of, true clinical trial data, that's still, you know, up for debate and discussion.
So you like pemigatinib better than futibatinib up front, you think, if you...
I think they're both really good agents, as I'll show you kind of the data comparison. But, you know, if you have a patient where you're thinking that you want to maybe stretch out your treatment, then you might be able to do pemigatinib first, with the mindset that if you do develop resistance, you might be able to get additional mileage with the initial first generation of FGFR inhibitors with futibatinib post and everything. However, if you are really saying that a patient, let's say, is progressing quite symptomatic and you need to like ensure that you get the maximum ability for response, then I think I might do futibatinib for kind of that a little bit more broader coverage and everything and be able to, you know, really try to give the patient the best chance for that initial response.
Perfect. And, you know, like we do in everything in oncology, all right, let's move this up front and combine it with everything else we have. I mean, so either a single agent combination, do you see a place for the FGFR inhibitors in the front line?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So there's an ongoing, you know, clinical trial that's comparing, pemigatinib versus, chemotherapy in the first line. And as you alluded to, is there a role for chemo with FGFR2 inhibitors, or is there other rational combinations potentially with IO? And those are, again, ongoing discussion in terms of clinical trial design currently.
All right, we'll let you dive into the data now.
Yeah, sure. So, I'll start with, really kind of going through the lines of therapy. So as I mentioned, in terms of first line treatment, it's really focusing on chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. So this is the phase 3 TOPAZ-1 clinical trial that combined the combination of gemcitabine plus cisplatin plus durvalumab, followed by durvalumab maintenance therapy after 6 months of chemo versus just gemcitabine and cisplatin versus placebo maintenance. And this was really a global phase 3 study with a primary endpoint in terms of overall survival. And this was really the first phase 3 trial to demonstrate that the addition of immunotherapy to standard of care chemotherapy can increase survival in our patients with biliary tract cancers. Following this trial, there was also the KEYNOTE-966 trial that took place around the same time. And as I highlighted, the main difference here is that these patients not only started with gemcitabine plus cisplatin versus pembrolizumab versus gemcitabine plus cisplatin, but after the initial eight cycles of treatment or 6 months of treatment, they could continue with gemcitabine plus pembrolizumab versus continuation with placebo plus gemcitabine as maintenance. And again, the primary endpoint here is again overall survival in the first line biliary tract cancer patient population. So this really shows you kind of the results, and what you can see if you go down the columns is that these are really, really identical studies in terms of outcomes. So if you're looking at median overall survival, what you see in the TOPAZ-1 study is that you had a significant improvement in terms of median OS from 11.3 months with combination gem-cis versus 12.9 months with the combination of gem-cis plus durvalumab followed by durvalumab maintenance. And similarly, in the KEYNOTE study, in the control arm with GemSys followed by, you know, potentially Gem maintenance, median OS was 10.9 months, and that improved to 12.7 months with GemSys plus pembrolizumab, followed by Gem plus pembrolizumab maintenance. And similarly, in terms of progression-free survival, the TOPAZ-1 study had a significant progression-free survival advantage, 5.7 months in the control arm with GemSys, up to 7.2 months with the combination plus durvalumab. And then the KEYNOTE study, that didn't necessarily meet significance, PFS of 5.6 months, up to 6.5 months. Objective response rates were also, you know, very much, you know, similar. In the TOPAZ-1 study, the control arm of GemSys had a little bit lower in terms of ORR of 18.7% and up to 26.7% with the combination, whereas in the KEYNOTE study, these ORRs were identical at 29%. In terms of duration of response, they were also similar in overall disease control rates, you know, very similar between, you know, kind of control arms, as well as the IO. And for toxicity, I think this is, you know, what we're seeing also in real world clinical practice, right? You know, the addition of single agent PD-1 or PD-L1 therapy on top of chemo doesn't really necessarily lead to a lot of additional toxicities, which I think is, you know, reassuring for our patients. And I think this is really what helps us lay out the road that, you know, if you get good control on a patient after 6 months of treatment, then would you really, you know, kind of have that discussion with your patient to potentially go on a chemotherapy break with the overall good tolerability of the single agent PD-1, PD-L1 therapies?
So before we move on to the FGF, so pretty similar looking outcomes in those previous data, right?
I mean,
almost superimposable.
Absolutely.
So no clear winner in that space. I guess what we've always done in other disease states is try to find some biomarker that, you know, tends to say, well, if this is a mismatch repair, then that person's going to do really well. If this PD-L1 expression, then lung. I mean, do we have any, can you read the tea leaves and say, is there some subset here based on some biomarker that tells us if the immune checkpoint adds more value versus not? Is that being diluted out in some small niche population here?
Yeah, you know, I wish we do, but we don't. Even with the original single agent IO studies and refractory line setting, we weren't able to necessarily tease out a biomarker in terms of, you know, PD-L1, PD-1 expression in the tumors. We don't necessarily have a good correlation even with, you know, CPS scores, or other things. These studies have also looked at in terms of mutational profiling of these patients to see whether or not there were certain types of alterations that lead to response, and that didn't necessarily show that there was necessarily a alteration that drives response either.
Excellent. All right. Moving on to the FGFR space.
Yeah, so going into FGFR, so, you know, as I mentioned, I think what's unique about cholangiocarcinomas is that we really need to continue to profile these tumors, because certainly up to anywhere between, you know, 15% to probably 18% of our patients will have potential alterable genomic alterations. Certainly FGFR2 fusions as well as rearrangements are exclusively found in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, and this probably represents anywhere from 10 to 16% of patients in the U.S. and Europe. Pemigatinib is a selective potent oral inhibitor of FGFR 1, 2, and 3. And this was the initial FGFR 2 inhibitor that was developed, and this was based off of the FLIGHT 202 study, which looked at patients with unresectable cholangiocarcinoma that had progressed after one or more lines of systemic therapy. And these patients, depending on their differences in terms of FGFR alterations, they received open-label pemigatinib, and they continued with the primary endpoint being really objective response. We'll really focus on kind of the top row in terms of those patients that have FGFR2 fusions as well as rearrangements. And the reason why is that, you know, for those patients that have non-fusion or rearrangement alterations in terms of other FGFR2 alterations like amplifications or mutations and everything, targeting that with the current FGFR inhibitors have not really been effective at all. So along with the FIGHT study, this is the PHOENIX study with futibatinib. And what you can see is that a very similar design. Again, those patients that have unresectable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas carcinomas that had a FGFR2 fusion or rearrangement progressed after one prior lines of therapy. And here they received futibatinib, 20 milligrams Q-day for every 21-day cycles and continued and primary endpoint of objective response. So this shows you kind of the comparison in the data in terms of the key efficacy as well as safety outcomes. What you can hear is, you can see here in terms of efficacy is, again, you know, very, you know, consistent data for a relatively similar patient population. Median PFS with pemigatinib in this patient population from the FIGHT 202 study was 7.0 months versus futibatinib from the Phoenix study was 9.0 months. And in terms of median overall survival, 17.5 months with pemigatinib from FIGHT 202 and for futibatinib from Phoenix was 21.7 months. Overall, very high objective response rates. You know, now you're seeing response rates really anywhere from 37 to 42% in our patients with cholangiocarcinoma, and certainly very good you know, disease control rates. We highlighted that there is the incidence of, you know, potentially different types of AEs, which I'll show you in the next slide. And as a result of that, you know, if you look at kind of grade 3 or higher AE events, this tends to be a little bit higher due to either laboratory abnormalities or certainly symptoms that patients will encounter. So as a result of this, as we mentioned, you know, where is this going? Is this going to move into, like, you know, the first line study? So this is the FIGHT 302 design, which is really comparing first line pemigatinib versus gemcitabine plus cisplatin for patients with advanced cholangiocarcinoma with FGFR2 rearrangements. And I think this study is should be close to, you know, accrual, and they're probably just waiting for, you know, potential readout going forward. For the toxicities that we mentioned, this is really where I think it really kind of takes that village that you mentioned and everything to, you know, be able to manage some of these toxicities. So on the right-hand side, we've really highlighted some of the key toxicities in terms of eye disorders with central retinopathy as well as blurred vision. You have laboratory abnormalities with hyperphosphatemia, so you have to be very aggressive in terms of the management of the phosphate levels, alterations in a patient's diet using, you know, potentially sevelamer as well. And then, you know, certainly the nail bed toxicities, oftentimes my patients might have to, you know, wear gloves in terms of the things that they're doing. And then also getting, you know, dermatology involved relatively early to help with additional symptomatic management. So this is, you know, you're going to need that group with ophthalmologists, you know, dermatologists, and as well as yourself as a medical oncologist being very proactive with that hyperphosphatemia.
For sure, on the ophthalmology side, you know, the conversations I've had with patients on these drugs is the ophthalmologist and I communicate, you know, because if you go in the retinopathy and they see that, you withhold the drug according to label. You know, once it improves, then you can restart. There are dose adjustments on the label, but it's really a very interactive, you know, toxicity management process.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, moving. We talked about biomarkers in the IO space. Now I'm going to touch on sort of the PanHER2 data. So, Dr. Mulheron, you have a case for us.
The next case is presented by Dr. Mulheron.
She had obstructive jaundice, constitutional symptoms, and a 20-pound weight loss. When she was admitted to the hospital, she had a bili of 12. She had a 4-centimeter mass in the proximal ducts, but extrahepatic, and several large periportal nodes, some liver mets, the largest like 4 centimeters, and some bulky retroperitoneal nodes, bulky like 5 centimeters, to the point where she actually had hydronephrosis and needed a stent placed. So she had an ERCP, sphincterotomy, stent placement, and she had adeno, and she was HER2 positive. So what's the best treatment for this frontline? Standard treatment is platinum, gemcitabine, and then you can take your pick of pembro or durvalumab, whatever. Sometimes insurance plays a role. But a progression, what would you think would be the best option in this case? She's HER2 IHC3 plus, this drug zanidatamab. What about T-DXd in this case? Would you consider using a HER2 targeted treatment in the upfront setting instead of doing cis, gem, pembro, or durva?
Dr. Mulheron has never under asked questions. So you got quite a few thrown at you, but I think it's an intriguing question, right? What's the role of the TKI relative to, you know, novel therapies and T-DXd in this space? And so questions for your thought as we go through the data. first-line therapy in a 75-year-old with a bulky IHC3+ biliary cancer. And then I'm going to interject, you know, are you going to follow the our gynoc friends and dip down to the 2+ here? And would you consider first-line HER2 targeted therapy in that patient?
Yeah, so, you know, I think for now, in terms of first-line treatment, I would still go with the, you know, gemcitabine, cisplatin plus IO agent. You know, it's really trying to find that balance in terms of maximizing response, but also at the same time trying to create for multiple lines of treatment for the patient so that you can really try to stretch the value of each of the patients, each lines of therapy to get maximum value for the patient in terms of overall survival. I think, you know, what I would do with this patient is that, you know, I think there has really been, you know, breakthroughs here with both zanidatinib as well as T-DXd. You know, previously we had, you know, some activity with single agent trastuzumab. There were certainly, you know, studies with, you know, just trastuzumab combined with other things like chemotherapy, like FOLFOX or others. That there were also studies in terms of, you know, with trastuzumab and pertuzumab. But they didn't necessarily lead to kind of that robust response, and they didn't necessarily lead to kind of that long-term durability of response in terms of tumor control. So in this patient, particularly with, you know, relatively bulky disease, I think you need to, you know, elicit a relatively a quicker response in these patients. So that's why, you know, I think chemotherapy is still needed here. And then I would hold for the, you know, novel HER2 agents, either with zanidatinib or T-DXd in the second line setting.
And I can't recall, I don't think, do we ever look at T-DM1 in these spaces? It never got there.
No, it never got there. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. And regarding your question in terms of IHC2+, as I will show with the data as well, we really haven't really seen much responses for patients with IHC2+ in biliary tract cancer. So I would say for now, I wouldn't use it in a patient with IHC2+.
You'd really adhere to the,
yeah.
Okay. 3+ in the pan. And so it sounds like upfront, still stick with what we've got, two great trials that show very similar outcomes on, you know, platinum-based doublet plus an immune checkpoint inhibitor, then at progression, you know, FGFR, if you see the fusion, if not, for the IHC3+. But what do you think, in that patient, if you had a fusion and a HER2 3+, do you have a preference there?
Yeah, so we haven't really seen much of that because I think a lot of these alterations are somewhat, you know, mutually exclusive and everything. So we haven't really run into that, you know, scenario. I will say, you know, ultimately in the frontline setting, many of these studies with these agents, you know, for example, with zanidatinib, it's going into a frontline study, you know, with chemo, as well as, you know, T-DXd going to a frontline study with multiple, you know, different combinations and everything. So, I mean, that can definitely, you know, ultimately change our landscape going forward.
So earlier we compared, you know, platinum doublets with Pembro versus Durva. So let's take the ADC and think through, like, what do you think about tolerability versus efficacy of T-DXd relative to, you know, zanidatamab here?
Yeah, so I think this is where, you know, there's a little bit of a difference. You know, I think Zani's a little bit more tolerable in that sense and everything. The issue with, you know, T-DXd is obviously the pneumonitis and everything. And you know, we've been getting better with in terms of management of our pneumonitis, but, you know, this can certainly be, you know, very toxic when it does happen, and it can, you know, unfortunately lead to deaths. There was actually an investigator-initiated trial out of Korea looking at T-DXd during this time while the PanDestiny study was actually going, that led to the, you know, broad approval. And the, at least in the Korean study that was an investigator-initiated study, there were several patients that did develop pneumonitis to T-DXd. So I think that is, you know, kind of something to keep in mind as you're trying to, you know, use both of these agents.
We were discussing earlier in the lung space the obvious concern moving that from a breast cancer space to a lung cancer space where, you know, the underlying injury to the lung may be greater, more insults there. And so, you know, any indications from an ethnicity or other occupational hazard that increases your risk for this ILD, because that's clearly, I think that was the thing that scared everybody, at least for the general oncologists. We're a little more comfortable moving through that space now and managing, you know, the toxicity with those reductions in the nausea. We was a misstep early on, but we've kind of gotten a much better handle on that. But
Not that I'm aware of and everything, because I think even for other diseases that have used T-DXd, I haven't really seen, like, you know, kind of this differences in terms of ethnicity that we're seeing. But, you know, I think larger studies will ultimately be needed. You know, the PAN2 Destiny study with T-DXd for biliary tract cancers was more of a global population rate and everything, and we didn't necessarily run into that. Now, was it because it was done at very high academic, you know, sites and everything, as well as the community here in the Western part of the world, versus that investigator-initiated study that was just done at, you know, more in line with a few centers, you know, in the eastern part of the world. I think that just will take more to tease out.
All right. You want to dive into the data a little bit?
This is the Destiny pan-tumor study that I was referring to. So this was a study that enrolled various different types of patients with different types of solid tumors, including ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, pancreatic cancer, and biliary tract cancer was one of the cohorts, you know, from the study. And if you look at, you know, objective response here in terms of all patients that were enrolled on the study, which was 41 patients, it included one CR as well as 8 partial response, so ORR of 22%. And this really kind of shows you that breakdown and why I wouldn't use this in an IHC 2+ patient. So when they looked at IHC 2+ in these patients, the 14 patients, and there was zero response. And in the IHC 3+ patients, here the objective response is now 56.3% of patients achieving a response. Median duration of response is fairly good at 8.6 months for those patients that have a response. I actually have a patient that's been on, you know, for a long, long time, you know, with this treatment and everything. I would say eclipsing, you know, close to over 3 years, I want to say, on this agent and everything. So this really kind of shows you the potential power of this agent. But, you know, I would really restrict this in terms of the IHC 3+, you know, for now. And this is, you know, regarding zanidatinib. So this was the Horizon BTC01 study, you know, relatively similar study, but now this time specifically confined to biliary tract cancers with HER2 expression. And these patients, they were divided in terms of, you know, kind of two different cohorts. Cohort one, that was, you know, HER2 2+ or 3+ staining, for which they received zanidatinib, versus a cohort two that was really HER2 low expression, 0 or 1+ staining. But that cohort didn't really, you know, go anywhere. There was only 7 patients due to really a lack of efficacy in that patient population. And the primary objective here was, again, objective response rate.
A quick question before you get into the outcomes. Like, prior HER2 therapy was excluded, right?
Yes.
And the epitope here is different.
So it's essentially like kind of a bi-target in a way, targeting the HER2 and everything. So this is not an ADC and everything. It's specifically, you know, kind of a, what we call more of a dual HER2 target agent in a way and everything. So that can explain for, you know, somewhat differences between, you know, toxicity compared to DDXD.
Perfect. Sorry. Thank you.
So here are the response as well as safety from this agent with zanidatinib. So objective response here, at least from cohort one, is 41.3% for these patients. And again, you're having one complete response. Majority of these patients are, you know, partial response. And in terms of, you know, any grade AEs as well as grade 3 or higher AEs, still in terms of all comers for grade 3 or higher AEs, you're at 57.5% of patients. But for those that are actually treatment related, you're down to 18.8% of patients. Median PFS from this study was, you know, 5.5 months. And certainly there was no treatment related grade 4 or grade 5 AEs. So that's why, you know, I think there are these kind of, you know, subtle differences in terms of toxicity between this agent and T-DXd. I think we need a little bit larger studies, and I think the future studies that are trying to kind of confirm these findings from these smaller phase twos will really kind of tell us what is the long-term efficacy of these agents versus the toxicity that we might be giving as well. So kind of to conclude this section, in terms of summary, my, you know, standard of care first-line treatment for unresectable biliary tract cancers is really combination chemotherapy with gemcitabine plus anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 immunotherapy, whether it's durvalumab based off of TOPAZ-1 or pembrolizumab based off of KEYNOTE-966. Certainly, we need to continue to profile these tumors in our patients just because there are molecular targets, including FGFR2 alterations, as well as HER2-positive tumors that, you know, really allow us to give our patients the opportunity of a target therapy approach moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's a great call out, right? So if we pulled our data, like how many of these folks really got tested on IHC, you know, from the fusion standpoint, I think it's, you know, a call to action for us to really close that gap given the intervention available. Quick question. Other HER2 therapies, is there a role? Have you ever seen any data with tucatinib or other TKIs in that space?
Yeah, so there was an investigator-initiated trial with tucatinib, and I think the results are promising. ORR in line above 30% and everything. I think again the differences here are the differences of toxicity, right? You know, tucatinib, I think the issue is with diarrhea and everything that you have to deal with. And I think this really speaks to the highlight in terms of what do we do ultimately if we have all these agents? How are we going to sequence a HER2 positive patient through all these agents? And I think sequencing studies will need to be done to help us refine that. This is something that's also going on in colorectal cancer and everything, and so it's we're kind of a little bit later in terms of biliary tract cancers, but we'll have to figure those questions out as well.
I hope we don't have to relive the full Fox versus full Fury and kind of go back down that road. Yeah. Okay, jumping into the next will be hepatocellular carcinoma. We've got some cases, but quick question before we leave the biliary. So some of these patients have disease limited to the liver, right? In which case, resection, Y90, et cetera. I mean, how do you incorporate these systemic therapies for those patients? Do we have data to provide guidance there? Some of that will be adapted maybe from the HCC space, but thoughts there on the biliary?
Yeah, we definitely do have, phase two data in terms of, safety as well as efficacy when we combine liver-directed therapy plus upfront chemotherapy, particularly Y90 radioembolization, and that's been shown to be safe and potentially efficacious. So I think for patients that really have liver-confined disease and you're going to go for surgical resection as well as attempt for curative intent, which is really should be the goal in those patients, right, and everything, and get them to surgery because that's the only way to cure them with surgery, then we have oftentimes have combined in terms of liver-directed therapy plus chemo. There is also ongoing cooperative group study that's involving kind of perioperative liver-directed therapy with systemic therapy, and I think that will tell us a little bit more in terms of whether or not that's the right approach.
Perfect. All right, a case from Dr. Boche and Dr. Noble.
The next two cases are presented by Dr. Boche and then Dr. Noble.
I have a scientist from the NIH, Asian, Hep B positive, who had multiple lesions in his liver that we biopsied, and it comes back cholangiocarcinoma, but his alpha fetoprotein was 4,500. So is this a cholangiocarcinoma? Is this a cholangio / HCC tumor? And how would you manage this since it looks like it's somewhere between cholangio and hepatocellular or features of both?
He was in his early 50s, and long story short, I think he drank a lot more than he let on to. Looked like a very healthy guy. He came in with anemia. I'm like, we really got to get imaging and get you scoped. And then he got admitted with rip-roaring liver failure. He got like basically tumor thrombus, had tumor all over his liver, metastatic to bone. They did a bone biopsy that proved the disease. And so you know, he came to see me with like, you know, child PU class C, bad liver disease, but really wanted to try some treatment. So we put him on IO single agent, realizing that there's not a lot of data there, but he really wanted to try something. And unfortunately, his disease progressed pretty rapidly. What I have generally run into when I've seen the disease is managing their liver disease in conjunction with managing their cancer. You know, I think they're equally difficult problems in some ways. And so how do they work on managing those things, particularly with things like IO that can cause hepatitis? So just their words of wisdom on managing liver and the cancer together with treatment.
So a couple of questions. I think this comes up a lot, you know, and sometimes I wait on like our NGS, like GPS AI to kind of help guide, but we see these, you know, collision or for lack of a better term. What are your thoughts on HCC versus cholangio? How do you define that? Because those are, you know, historically different treatment paths, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And I think this is really where we've started to evolve in terms of, you know, kind of diagnosing these patients. So, you know, HCC, as you know, does not require a histologic or pathologic diagnosis to make a diagnosis. So in a certain context of a patient, let's say with, you know, hepatitis B, based off of imaging criteria, you can make the diagnosis. But more and more, we've been recommending kind of biopsies for these patients just for this, you know, particular scenario where you can potentially have either mixed tumors, as well as the fact that there are, you know, trials that are ongoing that's looking at kind of targeting certain pathways that's involved with HCC. So they might set the patient up for, you know, kind of future trials as well. I think in this case, you know, I would, you know, highly suspect that this is a mixed cholangio HCC. It's probably only showing cholangio due to the fact that depending on your biopsy, you might have a relatively small biopsy sample and everything. And if you actually get, you know, surgical specimens, and we've seen it, we've gotten surgical specimens of these patients, and essentially like one portion of the surgical specimen is like cholangio, and then the other portion is HCC, and you kind of see this collision like you're talking about kind of in the middle in terms of survival of the fittest between the tumors in a way. You know, how I would manage this is that, you know, before when we looked at these tumors, there was an old kind of retrospective study that showed that if you use, let's say, you know, gemcitabine and cisplatin, as well as our prior treatments for, you know, HCC with, you know, sorafenib, there was really no difference in terms of overall survival, depending on if you treated this as like a cholangiocarcinoma or if you treated this like HCC. Now that we have, you know, chemoimmunotherapy, I think it's a no-brainer for us now, because we can certainly give them, you know, gemcis plus a anti-PD-1, PD-L1. We know that that has activity for the cholangiocarcinoma component. And we know that those single agents, immune checkpoint inhibitors also have activity for the HCC component. So that's really how, you know, we're really treating this. And there are some, you know, smaller groups and consortiums, you know, within the United States that's trying to define this and see whether or not, hey, you know, if that's what a lot of us are doing, you know, can we potentially combine chemo plus, you know, some type of, you know, IO combination as well going forward to really kind of hit both.
Right. And does the VEGF fit in there, right? We've done that in the lung space, right?
So. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, open. Like, you know, we were part of this study that was, you know, recently published with, you know, GemCis plus atezolizumab plus, you know, bevacizumab. And this was a signal finding study for biliary tract cancers. And it appears that in certain patient populations, maybe the addition of VEGF can lead to, you know, additional durable responses, but so far not necessarily for all comers.
With a high AFP level, maybe, or
kind of more like, you know, in terms of signatures that are associated with angiogenesis and everything. So, you know, potential VEGF, you know, higher expression levels.
Perfect. I think you've answered number two. And then these folks with really severe hepatic dysfunction and child's PUC, where the actual underlying liver disease probably predicts survival more so than the malignancy. Any thoughts for guidance there? I mean, do we just have to be strong and say, hey, I'm sorry?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a very challenging population. And I think, unfortunately, you know, I think we do have to, you know, really kind of understand, you know, kind of what our goals are, right, for our patients. It's, you know, we all want to treat and we all want to, you know, help them and everything, but we also don't want to hurt them, right? So I think if you really have a Child PUC patient where, you know, there is a component of that Child PUC score as a result of the underlying liver disease, you're not going to necessarily reverse that at all with any treatment that you're going to give right now. But you can make things worse. So as a result of that, you know, for Child PUC patients, you know, our recommendation has been, you know, best supportive care in hospice going forward.
I think my wife told me the same thing. You can always make it worse.
So, yeah.
All right, let's get into the data a little bit here. So,
You know, just wanted to update you in terms of some of the recent data that's come out. So this is, you know, the question of what do we do in the adjuvant space, right? Like, you know, up to this point, we really haven't had any positive data in terms of for patients that get resection for HCC and are at high risk of recurrence. So this is the IMbrave050 study looking at adjuvant atezolizumab plus bevacizumab. So these were patients that had confirmed diagnosis of HCC, underwent curative resection or ablation, but high risk of recurrence, defined as whether or not they had a tumor that's greater than 5 centimeters, multiple tumors greater than 3 centimeters, microvascular invasion, minor macrovascular invasion in terms of VP1 or VP2 disease, as well as grade 3 or grade 4 pathology in terms of differentiation. They were then randomized to receive atezolizumab plus bevacizumab for up to 1 year versus active surveillance, with the primary endpoint in terms of recurrence-free survival. So while initially we had a significant difference in terms of recurrence-free survival for those patients that got atezolizumab plus bevacizumab compared to active surveillance, and that was published in the Lancet in 2023, and we were all excited because we're like, oh, maybe we actually have a adjuvant treatment for our HCC patients undergoing curative surgical resection. What was really surprising to everyone is that with longer follow-up, and this presentation at ESMO this year, the recurrence-free survival benefit between the two arms was not maintained. So there was no difference in terms of median recurrence-free survival with treatment with atezo-bev, which was 33.2 months, versus active surveillance, which was 36.0 months. And this really prompted, you know, this letter that came out to all of us in the community, really saying that, you know, atezo-bev is not approved as adjuvant therapy for patients with HCC with high risk of recurrence after surgical resection or ablation, and should not be used in this setting. Because I think, you know, initially when we had, you know, somewhat of the positive data in terms of the early look, many of us were using this for our patients at high risk of recurrence. But with this longer follow-up data, it just tells us that, you know, we still don't have a adjuvant therapy. Now there's going to be still other ongoing trials looking at single-agent PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors, as well as a trial that's looking at durvalumab plus bevacizumab versus durvalumab versus observation. That's will really kind of tell. I think that what this really speaks to is that you know, recurrence for HCC is different compared to recurrence for other cancers. You can have recurrence for HCC just due to underlying liver disease, right? That cirrhosis is going to predispose you to recurrence. So that's not necessarily the same cancer coming back. It could be actual new cancer that's developing and everything, but that's still considered a recurrence.
So I had three patients that were, I was treating in accordance with IMbrave050, and then at ESMO, I see the data come out and I'm like, this is a painful conversation. Yeah, it's kind of a whoops conversation. Yeah. What'd you do with those patients who were on therapy? Did you stop? Yeah. Did you say, hey, you can finish? Or how did you approach
it? Yeah, you know, luckily for my patients, I didn't have as many of these and everything, because most of my patients had, you know, completed, you know, trial and everything. You know, for the patients that, you know, I think I had one or two, they only had about, you know, three cycles left, you know, from recall. And so it was really an informed decision. I kind of discussed that with them with the data. You know, they certainly had high risk features. I would say they probably even had higher risk features than what was enrolled in the study. So there's some thought that maybe with this trial, there wasn't necessarily enough people that were enrolled that was truly high risk and everything. And that's the patient patient population that might benefit and everything. So for those patients, I did continue and finish the regimen because they were otherwise tolerating it great. Like this is a good regimen in terms of toleration. I'm sure you've seen that.
Yeah, I think the guidance is good. Yeah, I had a patient who chose to bail, but in reality, when you looked at her, it was much closer to the lower risk end. And then the higher folks, like, hey, I got 2 months, I'll just finish.
Sure.
Okay.
So the other, you know, kind of area that we're really moving towards in terms of HCC that are newer is really, you know, what do we do with those that are locally advanced disease? So this is really trying to make the decision of, you know, should we move systemic therapy up further for locally advanced disease in addition to liver-directed therapy. So this is the EMERALD-1 study, which was looking at patients that really have locally advanced liver-confined HCC. This study did allow for patients that had side portal branch invasion in terms of VP1, VP2 disease. And these patients were then essentially randomized to receive either initially durvalumab plus TACE, followed by, you know, durvalumab maintenance therapy versus arm B that got durvalumab plus TACE, followed by durvalumab plus bevacizumab, and then arm C that just got the TACE plus placebo. And the primary endpoint here is really progression-free survival, with secondary endpoints being the kind of the single agent durva arm versus the placebo arm in terms of PFS as well, so along with overall survival. So what you can see here is that, you know, the addition of bevacizumab to durvalumab plus TACE, you know, probably does make a difference compared to TACE. So if you look at median PFS for the triplet arm versus, you know, TACE alone, what you're seeing is that median PFS improves from 8.2 months with TACE versus 15.0 months with durva-bev plus TACE. And if you look at the arm of the, you know, just the TACE arm versus just the durva plus TACE arm, you see that the median PFS only goes up to 10.0 months. And I think this is really consistent what we're seeing in the advanced setting, right? We know that single agent IO is, you know, good. It has some benefit for our patients. But if you really want to potentially achieve, you know, longer, you know, control, higher response, as well as really kind of impact that long-term survival, you probably need to go into a combination regimen strategy if you're able to do that. So these are the response rates, and here what you can see is that, again, you know, surprisingly, with just durva plus TACE, the objective response rate did go up to 41% in this study compared to 30% with just placebo plus TACE. But again, the durva bev plus TACE did lead to the highest objective response, close to 44% in these patients. You can control these patients for long-term, you know, period in terms of median duration of response. And the median duration of response now with durva-bev plus TACE is now at 22.1 months in these patients compared to, you know, just TACE alone of maybe 16 months at all. And similar to kind of the EMERALD study, this was also just reported out of ESMO. So this is the LEAP-02 study, which is now looking at the combination of TACE plus lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab for those patients that have liver-confined HCC. One main difference here is that this patient population had liver-confined HCC, but it did not allow for any vascular invasion in terms of, you know, portal vein thrombosis. So even side portal patients were excluded, you know, from this trial. And here, patients were then randomized to lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab plus TACE versus placebo plus TACE, with the primary endpoint being PFS as well as OS. And this is the PFS. What you can see is that there's a significant improvement in terms of PFS for those patients that were treated with lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab plus TACE, up to 14.6 months compared to 10 months with just placebo plus TACE. And in terms of overall survival, this is still, you know, relatively immature. There's maybe some, you know, slight separation of curves here and everything, but, you know, I think the question is going to be, you know, longer follow-up whether or not this you know, leads to a overall survival benefit or not. I think the challenges of this is that, you know, do you try to essentially combine everything up front and go for that PFS advantage without necessarily an OS advantage at this point in time? Or do you still go with essentially just, you know, taste followed by, you know, systemic therapy and everything if there's no overall survival advantage, and spare the patient the systemic regimen and the toxicities and, you know, maybe the time that it's required to come to the clinic to do that? So I think, you know, for a lot of us, ideally, we would like to have OS to be able to do this in combination. But there are certainly patients that have liver confined disease that will benefit from a combination strategy. So those patients that are, let's say, you know, bilobar disease, right, where you're not going to be able to cover the disease with just, you know, liver-directed therapy alone, and you're concerned that if they have relatively bulky tumors that they can get into trouble in terms of liver function, and once you get into trouble, then you're not going to be able to administer your systemic therapy. So there are certainly pockets of patients that where this kind of, you know, combination strategy with liver-directed therapy plus systemic therapy might make sense moving forward. So these are the response rates. Again, you know, what you can see is, you know, certainly very high objective response from the LEAP study, just like the EMERALD study. And if you look at modified RECIST, which is kind of taking into account enhancement of the tumors, now you're getting up to even, you know, 71.3% in terms of modified RECIST. So this just tells you how much you can potentially control these tumors with a combination strategy approach. You know, for systemic therapy, you know, real quickly in terms of, you know, what we still have, we certainly still have, you know, IMbrave 150, which was the first pivotal study to show superiority over sorafenib with the combination of atezo-bev versus sorafenib. So this is a first-line study. Key eligibility criteria was that all these patients underwent endoscopic assessment within 6 months prior to initiation of therapies and treated for varices per institutional standards. Other key criteria for this study was that it took a very broad patient population, so it allowed for patients with main portal vein invasion or VP4 disease, which other studies for HCC exclude, primary endpoint being overall survival and progression-free survival. And this shows you kind of the updated data now that shows a median overall survival in this patient population of 19.2 months compared to 13 months with sorafenib. PFS improvement from 4.3 months to 6.9 months, and an objective response rate of 30% in this patient population. Overall, very well-tolerated treatment in our patients. This is the other systemic regimen that we have for patients with unresectable, more advanced disease. This is the Himalaya study with the combination of durvalumab plus tremelimumab, otherwise known as the STRIDE regimen, because it uses a single agent, a single dose tremelimumab, high dose tremelimumab at 300 milligrams plus durva, followed by durva maintenance. And this was also compared to sorafenib with the primary objective being OS. Again, key thing here is that this trial did exclude patients with main portal vein thrombosis, so that's how you can potentially tease out the trial. This was an update at ESMO showing kind of the five-year survival data. What you can see here is median overall survival with sorafenib was 13 months versus 16 months with the STRIDE regimen. But now at 5 years, what you're seeing is that close to 20% of the patients were actually alive, you know, from the STRIDE regimen. So I think this really speaks to not only have our therapies gone better in the front line, but our therapies across the board and our management of these patients have, you know, gone better as well. Because even in the sorafenib arm for this, 10% of patients are getting to, you know, 5-year overall survival with sorafenib. So that just tells you, like, you know, the subsequent therapies are, you know, certainly improving for us as well. Second line, we really haven't had, you know, much changes. So we really have, you know, these agents were all approved after sorafenib. So you have regorafenib, cabozantinib that you can use in terms of TKIs. Ramucirumab for those patients that are AFP high, but not necessarily the most efficacious regimen, but certainly very tolerable. So if you have a frail or older adult and everything, ramucirumab is certainly better well tolerated compared to the TKIs like cabozantinib and regorafenib. And for whatever reason, if you didn't use a frontline immunotherapy combination, then we have, you know, nivo-ipi with accelerated approval from CheckMate 040, and we'll probably get a first line approval for nivo-ipi going forward, based off of the recent CheckMate 90W study, as well as single agent pembrolizumab based off of KEYNOTE 240.
looking at the PFS there, we got a little work to do, right?
Yeah. So second line, you know, I think that there's certainly, you know, room for growth, and that's really where, you know, trials come up.
All right, one quick last question. So any comer hits the door for HCC, unresectable, not curative therapy. I mean, are you a stride regimen guy or?
Yeah, so you know.
How do we make that call in the clinic? Yeah. Is there some, yeah, you know, arrow that points us compass-wise this way or that?
Yeah, so you know, I think I'm fortunate because I have a lot of trials and everything. We're actually going beyond just, you know, dual checkpoint inhibitors, and we're going to, you know, the arrow that I call, you know, kind of triplet treatments and everything. But you know, for full disclosure, we obviously played a pivotal role in terms of IMbrave 150. I think for me, getting an EGD is not an issue. And I know certainly in the community that is an issue and everything. And that plays a role in terms of decision making. But for me, without having the struggles of getting an EGD, then my preference is still with atezo-bev. And the reason why is because the overall consistency of the data in terms of overall survival, progression-free survival, as well as delay and quality of life, deterioration and quality of life. Whereas, you know, with STRIDE, unfortunately, there wasn't necessarily a difference in terms of median PFS. You certainly can have patients that respond to STRIDE, and they do very well. But that's, again, a select patient population. And outside of a biomarker, you know, for me, I don't think that's enough to drive me to make that decision. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, all of this is, HCC field is rapidly evolving. And I don't think we're going to have a lot of these discussions because I think we're just going to continue to push the envelope and continue to, you know, change the standard of care for our patients moving forward.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your insights. Sure. They were absolutely invaluable.